I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome back, folks. Dr. Joe Cantor, the state health officer for the state of Louisiana, joins us, and we appreciate same. Doc, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Noel. It's good to be back with you.
Doc, you and I have talked about this many times, but never did I think that the all clear would come from the president. Was wondering who makes the call as it relates to when this pandemic is over. I know we've talked about it at least three times, if not more. We've gone through this past several years, follow the science, follow the guidance, follow the experts, and then out of the blue, in a 60 Minutes interview, president says, it's over.
Done, huh? We're done. Well, we have talked about it a lot, and, I think it comes down to really what you mean by that. And, if you mean that the most disruptive phase with, closures and orders and disruption is past us, absolutely no question about that. No question at all. And has been the case for a number of months now, as we've talked about before. That doesn't mean that COVID is gone. And, this idea that we had initially in the pandemic that we would potentially eradicate the virus is just so far from reality right now, not a possibility. And we still have, the daily death average for the country is about 350 deaths a day. So, that's getting closer to what a really, really bad flu season would be, but not for a few months, just kind of year-round right now. So by that regard, it's still causing a lot of morbidity and mortality, still requires dedicated resources, still will be at least top 10, if not top 5 causes of death, probably for every state this year. So requires a lot of attention, but yeah, I agree. I think most people equate the term pandemic to mean mass disruption, significant impact on their lives. And I agree, we are not in that place anymore, thankfully.
So this is no longer than a pandemic of the unvaccinated. I'm having difficulty getting my head around this, right? And I've tried to give everybody both sides the benefit of the doubt through the past several years that we've discussed this. But when I go back to these previous statements that have been made, when on the one hand we're pushing COVID booster shots big time, the last three shows you and I have talked about this, and then all of a sudden out of the blue, he says, it's over. And it has moved from the pandemic of the unvaccinated now to no worries.
Yeah. And
I think he's ruining, in many respects, the credibility of the public health providers in this country by this mixed messaging. And you and I have talked about this a lot as well. And it doesn't end. It's continuing.
It definitely doesn't help that it seems like his advisors were caught off guard by that. That doesn't help the messaging.
Which is a pretty good sign that the messaging is all screwed up, right?
Yeah. the phrase pandemic of the unvaccinated, I do think that was true at an earlier part. It's obviously not true now. Look, we've got about 95% of the state has either been vaccinated or infected or both, about 85% of the state, Louisiana, has just been infected. So, you know, that creates a different situation than when we were mostly naive, or when 30 or 40% of the population had been infected. And, you know, we all know that the efficacy of these vaccines and boosters wanes over time. That's why they've introduced an updated one. So, yeah, I agree. The phrase pandemic of the unvaccinated, while it might have been true at an earlier point, is clearly not true anymore. I think the challenge here is, you know, it is important to be up to date on the vaccines and to get the booster, just like it's going to be important to get the flu shot this year. And those, you know, are important messages to push. And I think that the challenge here is to communicate that on one hand, but also acknowledge that, you know, COVID is not the disruptor that it was at earlier points. That doesn't mean that those vaccine campaigns are any less important. I think they're very important, particularly because we don't know what the flu season is going to hold. But there's absolutely no question that, you know, we are not discussing closures, disruptions, or orders the way we were. We've moved past that. I really don't see us going back to that. And whatever label one wants to put on it, I think, you know, it would be dishonest not to acknowledge that.
So would you agree or disagree with renowned artist John Barry, he wrote The Great Influenza, which was a history of the 1918 Spanish flu, and he basically says it's over when people decide that it's over. And most people seem to have decided it's over.
Yeah, I think John's a really smart guy. I think I agree with that. It was also said, I can't remember who wrote it, but there was an article a couple of days ago that said declaring the pandemic's over is more of an art than a science. I think all of those are true. You know, we're not when people talk about the pandemic, they're not thinking about the strict epidemiologic definition. They're talking about the disruption that comes with it. So I think that's very fair to say.
Well, but this is what I'm trying to get my head around, because you kind of characterize it, and not to be too overly aggressive about this, but this disruptive phase. I mean, that's a very subjective kind of terminology, right? And it kind of lends itself to what John Barry's saying. Well, if I don't want it to be a disruption in my life, I can just declare it's not a disruption. I'm going to go about doing what I got to do. I mean, the folks that had done that took on a lot of criticism throughout this pandemic. And now we find ourselves at a crossroad where we say, well, that's kind of the art of deciding one way or the other. Enough people decide, not disrupting my life. I'm done.
Well, I'll tell you, I hear that. I'll tell you how I think about it. You know, to me, the most dire parts of this pandemic, really the parts that necessitated a lot of the disruption that drove those decisions, were the threat of the hospitals collapsing, the threat of there just being absolutely no capacity to care for any more patients, COVID or otherwise, in the hospital. And we have not faced that threat in earnest in really almost 12 full months. Has not been nearly we've been tracking it and staying in close communication, but that has not been the threat the way that it was about 12 months ago and clearly before that. So in my mind, the stakes really have changed. That's a hard measure that I've looked to quite frequently throughout the pandemic.
So when the president makes this delineation, and that goes back to below the curve, and I was all in with that below the curve mentality approach to this, and you and I spent a lot of time talking about that, beating back a lot of skeptics, right, on that issue. Mm-hmm. But we make this declaration, the pandemic's over, but we don't relax any of the emergency declaration that's in place by the federal government. I mean, just the other day, we didn't allow a tennis player to play in the U.S. Open. And right on the heels of the U.S. Open, he declares, it's over. Yeah. It seems to me that we're playing it to the skeptics' hands about this is really more about government control. When you're not doing these things in concert with one another. And I think a lot of people are mystified by it. And it really, I think we've really misstepped here. And I don't mean to overplay this, but I know it's just a matter of time before this is the way it's going to be. This is where the dialogue, I think, is going to move.
Yeah, you know, my expectation is that the Fed, they're going to move rather quickly to signify the end of the federal public health emergency. A growing number of states have already done that on their end. We obviously have in Louisiana 6 or 7 months ago, because we no longer, you know, the facts on the ground no longer justified it, no longer necessitated it. So the governor ended his declared emergency in the state. My expectation is that certainly after Biden said this, that the feds will be moving in that direction too. They've either rolled back or in some cases lost in court some of the mandates they had. But you know, my expectation reading for the tea leaves on this is that we'll see the feds move to end that fairly quickly. There's a lot tied to that. I'll tell you, there's a lot of Medicaid implications tied to that because state Medicaid programs have not been allowed to disenroll any applicant while the federal emergency is in place. And it's potentially a lot of people that might lose coverage. So states are working through that. But I really think now that Biden has said this, we'll see that end pretty quickly.
So next step, who defines the new normal now? I mean, it seems to me this transition, because I don't really recall how we got to this flu vaccine, you know, situation. I know that we had on average 60 to 70,000 deaths, maybe 55 to 65,000 deaths as a result of influenza, you know, for a number of years. So who's going to be responsible? They say the WHO is not going to recall the pandemic. Obviously, the NIH or others here, FDA or others, are not going to kind of slide back or recall the pandemic. But who defines the new normal?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't know what the answer is. I'll tell you what my fear is that, you know, we equate moving past pandemic in those semantics to just accepting what the status quo might be. And I'm not prepared to accept that. You know, I'm not prepared to have 350 additional deaths every day in the country. I'll tell you, on an average flu season in Louisiana, we have somewhere in the ballpark of 500 or 600 deaths in an average flu season. In the month of August from COVID, we had 300 deaths. So far to date in September, we've had about 126 deaths. You multiply that out, you know, we can't sustain that for a year. That's way too much. I don't know what the right number is. I don't know if anyone knows, but I can tell you that's too much. So in my mind, it's how do we leverage public health tools? How do we leverage the medical system? How do we use the tools that we have to keep people out of the hospital with COVID? Which doesn't mean, you know, orders or mandates. It means promoting the vaccine, making sure people who are positive and high risk get connected to treatment, doing non-invasive public health tools to continue to reduce mortality. That's where my head is at. I'm not ready to accept that we're just going to have 300 to 400 additional deaths a month and just be okay with that.
There are a number of leading experts that agree with you. Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease at the University of Minnesota, says it's exactly on point as to what you're saying, that deaths have almost become an afterthought.
Yeah.
And says exactly what you just said. I refuse to accept this as the norm. What are we doing wrong? And where do we go from here?
Yeah. You know, I don't think we're fully leveraging treatments right now. You know, most of the deaths, not all, but most of them are preventable if the individual gets treated early enough. So we have more work to do leveraging that. There's still therapies that we haven't fully employed. We've talked about this medicine, Evusheld, before. This is a prophylactic medicine given to people who are at severely high risk. We have a lot of work to do to use that. It's still free from the federal government. And we're not doing as good of a job as we can do to make sure the people most at risk are offered it. So I still think there are things, relatively easily things, on the table that we need to be using to do that. You know, the conversation here is just it's become fraught because of the experience with mandates and orders. And I think it's I think once people realize that we're not, that no one serious is suggesting new orders or mandates right now, then you can open up the conversation a little bit and talk about what really might be helpful and practical.
Yeah, I guess the reason I seem a little aggressive about this is I never, even in spite of the uncertainty that you and I have talked about as to who calls this, right?
Yeah.
I never thought that it would happen in such a haphazard way. Kind of a fleeting comment in a 60 Minutes interview. And when I think about the angst and anxiety and disruption in people's lives, I don't know about you, Doc, but I feel like this. I'm cheated, you know, that I thought that there would be a more robust conversation, presentation of folks from the CDC, the NIH, you know, connecting the dots because we have been browbeat with follow the science, follow the guidelines, follow the experts. And there's nothing, nada. Zippo.
Yeah. I agree. I would have liked to see that too. I mean, we we've discussed this before. We've clearly moved past the communication strategy of, you know, just believe this because I'm saying it. You know, that doesn't fly anymore, nor should it fly anymore. So it shouldn't fly for something like this. You know, I don't disagree that the worst of the pandemic is over, or however one wants to phrase that. I'm on board with that, but I think I feel like you. I would like to see that expressed in a robust display of data, expert opinion, and really get into the nuance of it. After 2.5 years of this, I think we all deserve that.
No, I mean, I just was traveling yesterday, and I was just jotting some notes down, and I was kind of like, I can't believe this. I mean, because you and I have talked exhaustively about this to try and keep people informed, right, with what's breaking out there, what is the latest as it relates to science and everything else, and just this kind of fleeting train of thought. And now this is the beginning of the end, so to speak, figuratively, on this issue. It's just a huge letdown. I don't know that that's the right term, but anyway, I won't belabor it anymore. All right, we got to get to a break. We're visiting with Dr. Joe Kanter, the Louisiana State Health Officer. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
All right, football fans, the NFL draft is almost here, and the Free Odyssey app brings you the latest coverage from the biggest sports radio stations across the country. Which players will help your team the most? Who will make a draft day trade? Will they be ready for week one? The local conversations about the team you love. All streaming free right here on the Odyssey app. AUDACY. Download it today.
Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Dr. Joe Kanter, the Louisiana State Health Officer. Doc, the new variant BA 2.75.2, I think is how it's referred to. Have we seen that here in Louisiana?
To my knowledge, yet we haven't formally identified it. Doesn't mean it's not here. It's not pulling on any substantial rank right now nationally. I mean, nationally, we're still at like 88, high 80s percentage BA.5. And then the biggest variant that's just on the radar right now nationally is this BA4.6, particularly because it has some immune evasion with some of the therapeutics like Evusheld. The one you're mentioning, I don't believe we've identified in Louisiana. I could be wrong, but if we have, not in any substantial numbers yet.
Yeah, I was just kind of curious. I saw it mentioned in an article, but I hadn't really seen anything reported on it.
Yeah, you know, I think it just – it's tough because there's just going to always be more variants, and it's really hard to know what to get worked up over until you kind of see what it does out there.
Yeah. Doc, I know West Nile virus cases on the rise.
Yeah, and this is a concern. We put out a press release on this yesterday to try and ring the bell a little bit. We're fourth in the country, actually, for cases so far. And we're having the worst season that we've had in the past few years. Mosquito pools are up, and there's routine testing of there's mosquito traps across the state, and those mosquitoes are routinely tested for West Nile, particularly during the season. So the pools that are positive for West Nile are up considerably, about double from what they were last year and the year prior. We're seeing a significantly larger amount of the very severe form of West Nile virus, which is neuroinvasive disease. Now, most people that get West Nile either have no symptoms or very mild, you know, little fever, kind of like low-grade flu symptoms. And they never get tested, nor should they, and it resolves in a couple of days, and it's no big deal. About 1% of people that get West Nile will go on to develop neuroinvasive disease. This is a severe disease. This can lead to paralysis. It can lead to permanent disability. We've had 33 cases of West Nile so far this year. That's a lot. For this point, we're about halfway through the season. That's a lot. And 5 of those cases have died. Most of these cases get ICU-level care. And so it is a big concern. Not sure why we're having a bad season as compared to years past, but we are. And so the point of putting that notice out there was to try and let people know what they can do to help protect themselves.
I just happened to notice, I live in Jefferson Parish, and I've seen the mosquito control spray vehicles out and about a lot more often than I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, you know, actually fortunate in Orleans and Jefferson Parish, there's excellent mosquito abatement. And, you know, for example, the New Orleans Mosquito and Rodent Control Board is a very, very old institution and has been a national leader. Their director, Dr. Claudia Regal, is an international expert. They really have a considerable amount of expertise there, and they do a really good job. I struggle to think what it would be like here without their efforts. They spray when they have to. They really do a fine job. But, you know, living in the swamp, there's only so much you can do. So you know, I'm comforted that we have their efforts and expertise, but, you know, you're still gonna have mosquito problems. Most of these mosquitoes that carry West Nile, they're called container mosquitoes. They breed in small amounts of upstanding water, typically around the house, like a saucer that's overturned, a pot that's overturned, fills with water, and that's what they breed in. And they can breed in as small as a bottle cap overturned with water and really kind of become a pest around the house. So the flip side of it is actually pretty easy to control the population around your house, and all you have to do is turn over any standing water. I do that at my house every 2 days during the summer. It can actually be very effective at reducing the amount of mosquitoes that are within, you know, 100 feet or so of your house.
Yeah, and most people don't think of that, right? They're thinking of much larger pools of water as being the breeding grounds.
No, absolutely. And, you know, for other types of mosquito-borne illness like malaria and dengue, that's absolutely right. But for West Nile, it's really significant on these container mosquitoes. So you can actually help a lot, you know, around your house. What we try and tell folks is, you know, you take your personal precautions, like you wear mosquito repellent, you wear long sleeves when you can, although it's hard to sometimes. And when the mosquitoes are biting, you try and limit your exposure during those hours. But if folks can, you know, a couple times a week, really pay attention to overturning any small amounts of standing water in their house, that really does make a big difference.
And I guess the next question I'm going to ask you, it feels like I'm going through this list of infections, afflictions, or whatever, but the monkeypox update.
Thankfully, not too much new. We have 2 new cases to report today. That puts the state total up at 240 cases. There's about 24,000 cases nationally. I'm happy to say we have not really seen an increase since the Southern Decadence Festival. We obviously feared we would. We put a lot of energy into getting additional vaccine ahead of that and then putting it out there. We've given about 11,000 doses of vaccine in the state. That puts us ahead of a number of other states. It's been hard work. A lot of partners have helped with that. We've done vaccine events in clinics, at venues, at bars, really trying to meet people where they're at. And I think it's working. You know, we've not seen a sharp increase since that event. We've seen small, you know, low numbers every day like we would expect. So I'm optimistic that we are getting ahead of this outbreak right now. And I'm happy to say that.
Has there been any more research as to, you know, a lot of folks are exposed asymptomatic as to why others, you know, end up with the blistering and the like?
You know, with monkeypox, we actually don't think there's a ton of asymptomatic infections. We think most people infected with monkeypox get the lesions. And that's really how it's been transmitted. It's, you know, while it's technically possible in a lab environment to spread this through the air, you know, what we're seeing is human-to-human spread by virtue of people touching those open lesions. So asymptomatic infections have not been a real problem or a driver on this. And that helps with the control. I mean, it's easier to message. I mean, the guidance to people who are infected with monkeypox is as long as you have active lesions, you're infectious. And so you really have to avoid contact during that time. Without having to worry about asymptomatic spread, it makes it much, much easier from a public health standpoint.
Yep. When we come back, we'll talk about the mental health and addiction crisis that seems to be getting worse, not getting any better, when we return with Dr. Joe Cantor, Louisiana State Health Officer for the state of Louisiana. Stay with us, folks. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Dr. Joe Cantor, the state health officer for the state of Louisiana. Doc, we know that ageism, I guess one's age and comorbidities have really played into the severity that people have experienced that have been infected with COVID. But many experts have described COVID that it can be like a lit match thrown into a dry bush. And that seems to be what's contributing a lot to this mental health and addiction crisis that we're experiencing.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. It's obviously multifactorial, you know, as most things are. And for addiction and mental health, people have been hit from a couple of different angles. People who were stable in treatment before the pandemic hit, in many cases, had that treatment disrupted. During the first year of the pandemic, there were considerable barriers to people starting treatment who need it. A lot of clinics were closed and so forth. And so that limited people's access to treatment who needed to start it. And then on top of that, you have the trauma of the pandemic. You have, you know, people knowing people get sick and dying. You have the economic trauma, you know, everything that goes with that, that just exacerbates people's underlying conditions. So I think you add that all together and you end up where we are with a very sizable mental health and addiction crisis. The opioid addiction part of this is even made worse by fentanyl. And, you know, now fentanyl is ubiquitous. It's in almost 100% of street-bought heroin, which means that the chance that someone's going to severely overdose is much, much higher. It just makes the road much more perilous for people who are on the road to recovery. So that's where we are right now, and it really is staggering. I wanted to mention that there was an excellent conference in Baton Rouge, the statewide mental health symposium and opioid action conference that concluded this week in Baton Rouge. It's a three-day conference. The governor spoke at the beginning of it to launch it off. And it was the first time since COVID that this had happened in person. And there was a lot of good energy in the room. You know, I am comforted that there's a lot of folks in this state that are really committed to this issue. And I think there are some areas that we're doing exceptionally well on. You know, one example, this national 988 crisis line. So now you can call 988 and get connected with a crisis operator. We're one of the top states in terms of fielding those calls actually in state. There's a lot of states that have to farm those calls out because they don't have the expertise. We have it here. So we have the good building blocks, but there's no question we have a lot of work to do on this issue.
If you would, for the benefit of the listening audience, I know you've had folks present themselves while on fentanyl in the ER. Describe it, if you would.
Well, you know, for practical purposes, it acts like any other opioid. It acts like heroin or morphine or Percocet, anything like that, in that it suppresses your respiratory drive. And people typically die because they stop breathing, and then they go into cardiac arrest from that. The problem with fentanyl is that it's just so much more potent than the other opioids we've dealt with in the past. And what we see frequently with overdoses in the ER is someone who is using a drug and either doesn't know it has fentanyl in it or doesn't know how much it has in it, and inadvertently takes a dose that's way, way stronger than what they've used in the past. And so they overdose on that. Now, the reversal medicine Narcan works, you know, pretty much just as well for fentanyl as it does for other opioids. Sometimes you have to give more, but it still works. So if we get to someone in time, if they get to the ER in time, the success rates are pretty good. I think the problem is that for people that have delayed presentations, and if you've been down for a while, not breathing for a while, every minute you're not breathing, that's time that your brain is not being supplied with oxygen. And so even if you can get someone's cardiopulmonary status back, even if you can get their heart beating again, they likely have suffered some severe brain damage in the process. That's why these things like Narcan, like giving Narcan out to lay people in the community, putting it in homes, is so important, because just like an EpiPen for a bad allergic reaction or anaphylaxis, if you can get someone that treatment quicker, you really increase the odds that you'll be able to save them with a meaningful recovery.
Yeah. You know, and a lot of folks are confused as to why fentanyl is out there in the huge supplies that it is. And they don't realize that these are drugs that are made in a lab, right? They're relatively easy to make, not real difficult. They're not plant-based, so you're not having to grow acres and acres and acres of a plant like cocaine to be created.
Yeah, that's right. It's just easier for the cartels. You know, before they had to grow opium, harvest it, turn it into heroin and all that stuff, and that's an expensive process. You know, now it's fentanyl. Fentanyl typically comes in a powder form. It's synthesized in a lab, usually in China, shipped over into Central America or Mexico, received by cartels. And then for them, once they have that powder form, it's much easier and cheaper for them to just introduce that into their heroin supply than it is to actually make straight heroin. You get a lot more bang for your buck, so to say, because the stuff is so concentrated and so powerful. So they can make more product, and they can make more product cheaper. But, you know, no one's really checking how much they're putting in. And so one batch has this amount, the next batch has twice as much, and that's what leads to these overdose spikes. Really hard thing to control. I mean, fentanyl, really, it's so powerful that, you know, a small package of it sent overseas can be enough to put in so much supply of drugs that it becomes a really challenging thing for the drug enforcement agencies to crack down on, because it's relatively small and concentrated.
Yeah, and I think from a public health perspective, it's going to be the looming challenge in the future.
Right. And, you know, again, you know, for people who are in recovery from addiction, particularly opioid addiction, what a lot of people don't realize is that relapse is an expected part of that process. You know, most people who are in recovery have relapsed at some point. It's a known and anticipated part of the process, because addiction can be so powerful and hard to break. The challenge now is, if you relapse and you happen to relapse with some stuff that plays with fentanyl, the potential consequences are just so much greater. You're just so much more likely to overdose because of the strength of fentanyl. So it really does make the road to recovery so much more perilous than it has been in the past.
And one hates to look at it in this perspective, but when relapse becomes synonymous with death, that is the public health crisis.
That's exactly right. That's the best way to put it. You know, in years past, before we were dealing with fentanyl, if you relapsed, you know, you relapsed, and we had to deal with that. Now, you're so much more likely to die if you relapse. And again, I mean, I think listeners who have loved ones struggling with addiction know this. Relapse is ubiquitous with recovery for many, many people.
Yeah, absolutely. Doc, as always, this hour flew by. Thank you so much for being so straightforward on so many different issues. We always appreciate Sam. Have a great week.
Thank you, Noel. You too.
All right, it's Dr. Joe Cantor, Louisiana State Health Officer. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, when we come back, we'll go to the talk lines, 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. We want to hear from you. What's top of mind for you this week? When we return, stay with us.
All right, football fans, the NFL Draft is almost here, and the free Odyssey app brings you the latest coverage from the biggest sports radio stations across the country. Which players will help your team the most? Who will make a draft day trade? Will they be ready for week one? The local conversations about the team you love. All streaming free right here on the Odyssey app. A-U-D-A-C-Y. Download it today.